Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
All right, Liam, how are you doing?
Not too bad this week, Matt. How's the new family going?
The new family, as in the additional nodes that we've added, horizontally scaling out.
Yes, I wasn't sure if you were going to keep the analogy going. I was thinking about that earlier.
I may as well. Good. Everyone's doing really well. Everyone's very tired and grumpy.
I can tell.
Yeah,
I can tell.
Yes, I'm pretty tired and grumpy. And Riley is very tired and grumpy. And pretty much the only person who's not tired and grumpy is the baby. Well, actually, she's tired and grumpy as well. Yeah, everyone's tired and grumpy.
Yeah. I think the best part about that is before too long, you'll forget about it.
Will I? Is that right?
Well, I mean, my kids are a lot older, and those early days, I think they've just drifted off into history, so yeah. I don't really think about them.
Yes, well, yeah. I'm sure that will happen. How about you? You all right?
Yeah, doing well. Lots of work coming up, putting out a lot of proposals and whatnot, so it's keeping me busy, which is good. It's really good this time of year. I think it feels like the market's sort of starting to shift a bit.
Yeah.
So hopefully...
I'm definitely seeing that as well.
It'd be interesting to see if any of the listeners are noticing the same, but you know, I didn't want to put it out there, but I'll probably be starting to look for getting some help soon, which is interesting. Which is quite promising. Yeah,
that sounds exciting. That sounds promising. That sounds so reading between the lines, is that a bit of growth for Incubed?
It's like I said, there's proposals going out there, so, and some of them are looking a lot more promising than others, so yeah, it looks like there's hopefully a bit of growth coming, which is awesome.
That's great. Yeah.
So this week, Matt, we had an old friend of ours reach out.
Friend of the show, yeah.
A great friend of the show, yes. We've spoken about Chris quite a bit recently, but he asked us if we could do a bit of a shameless plug for him.
He did, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so Chris is organizing a brand new conference coming up.
Yeah, so that's really exciting to hear about, because obviously, like you said, old friend of the show, Chris Simon, we both of us found the conversation that we had with him to be very influential. So it's really exciting, aside from anything else, just to have an opportunity to see him speak again. So this is, as you said, a new conference that he's organizing, Analysis, Design and Architecture. So it's obviously, focused on those things. So it's obviously all about software design, software architecture, really from the perspective of drawing together the two disciplines at that intersection of where Chris's expertise is, which is the business side and the technology side. So should be a really exciting conference.
Yeah, so just a bit further more information about that. That's a one-day conference down in Melbourne on Friday the 8th of November. I know you and I, we're trying to organise a trip down to Melbourne just to see if we can get down there, which would be really exciting. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it should be good. Should be good. Yeah, BDD, another conference.
That's it.
BDD at ADA.
Yeah, that's it. You know, we might be able to find some people down there to talk to. I know I'm looking through the agenda now, and if you recall, I told you about a talk I saw from Lee Dunkley, the Preventing EMU Wars. So that's going to be down there.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Which would be good. I'd happily see that one again. And yeah, we might be able to see if we can snag a few chats while we're there.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah. And I think we've probably got a bit more to share about this conference, but maybe we'll keep that under our hats for now.
Yeah, look, I think there's some exciting news to come out from that one. So
let's not be selfish. Let's share, but let's do it at the end, shall we?
Yeah, let's keep everyone on the hook, okay?
All right. Yeah, shameless hook. So let's talk a little bit more about this concept then. So analysis, design, and architecture. So obviously we're big fans of Chris, and we're big fans of DDD, and we're big fans of TDD. Like we've spoken extensively about these topics.
Mm-hmm.
But let me ask you this. Are we taking them too far?
It's
a very open question, obviously.
It's a very, very open and almost a very leading question. But look, there's the potential. There's the potential in the industry for people to be very dogmatic about their approach to software.
Yeah.
Right. And by that, I mean, yes, you see people from the TDD background, where they say absolutely everything is test first from the very first line of code you write all the way through to the very end. And then prior to seeing Chris's talk this year, my approach to TDD was a little bit more, I guess, pragmatic rather than dogmatic there, right? In that I would always approach complicated and complex logic TDD tests first.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
But a lot of the run-of-the-mill stuff and a lot of the everything else that was less complicated or that required less brain cells to implement, I would always forego those unit tests, right? And another aspect of that that I picked up early in my career was using TDD as an approach to solving bugs.
Right.
Right. So if there's a bug, you know, if you pick up a bug ticket, the first thing you should do is write a unit test that proves that the bug exists.
Yep. Okay.
Right. Because then when you have fixed the bug, you have proof that you have fixed the bug.
Yep.
And you also now have a unit test in there that helps prevent any regressions from sneaking back into the system.
Yes.
So
everything that you've just described is by definition 100% not TDD.
No, it's not. It is within the confines, within the bounded context of fixing a bug or implementing a complex piece of logic. But no, it's not TDD in the overall sense of the word TDD, right?
Yeah.
So this is a very long-winded way of saying, to answer your question, that I did at one point believe that, yes, it could be taken too far.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always err on the side of caution. Maybe it was due to laziness or whatever else, but I would err on that side of caution. And yeah, not follow the TDD straight down the line.
Okay. So something that I've said a few times before, the frustration that I have around testing is that I often find that a lot of the unit tests or integration tests that I write or I read often feel like they are there to do what you just described, which is to prevent regression,
mm-hmm.
especially when it's not TDD. So if someone's written some code and they've, you know, if I'm reviewing a PR and I see some code and I see a test for that code and the test is not defined in business language, that test is there to prevent someone breaking that person's code in the future.
Correct.
Which is not without value, right? But I get frustrated because my feeling is that those tests have value, but your tests should fundamentally be about expressing the quote unquote requirements, because I know that that's a loaded term as well, but your tests should effectively be about
expectations
or the functionality, the desired functionality of the system, the problem, what have you. The test, you should have a way of having tests that say, does this thing do what we need it to do?
Yes.
Right. Now, I take that a step further because I actually don't think that's just confined to tests. I think that extends to everything and can be extrapolated to everything. Right. Now, let me give you an analogy. Let's say you are a business and let's say, pick a random business.
Qantas.
Pick a different random business. all right, let's say you're Qantas, right? Now, Qantas is a large company and they have, I'm really trying hard not to make sarcastic and snarky comments here. I was going to say they have multiple different departments. Obviously, one of the most funded departments is the how can we screw customers out of more money department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a lot of businesses.
Did you see all the things going around this week about, because you know, we've got grand final weekend this weekend.
Yeah,
in Melbourne.
Yeah.
You've seen all the ticket prices on Qantas, yep, to Melbourne, flights to Melbourne this weekend?
Oh, well, yes, I have.
Way off topic, right?
Yeah, you want another business?
Yeah, let's have another business.
What industry are you thinking?
Doesn't matter. Let's just randomly say, let's say you are a business that operates department stores around multiple locations around the country.
Yep.
Okay. So you will have a finance department, a facilities department, an IT department, an HR department, potentially,
mm-hmm,
right? None of those departments are there to do the core business of the company. The core business of the company is retail.
Yep.
So the core business is effectively having products on the shelves and having customers come in and buy them.
Sure.
And then there are things that support that, like supply chain and procurement.
Yep.
So obviously acquiring stock, distribution. But then there are those other things that I mentioned, which are kind of ancillary, right? So they're not there to do the work that the business does, but they are there to support the business being a business.
Yep.
Where I'm going with this is an analogy for what we do as software developers, right? So when we write code, when we follow practices like domain-driven design or test-driven design, when we follow design patterns, and when we follow, you know, different architectures, and we follow object-oriented principles, like Solid and everything else. That's not the business of what we do, right? Those are things that we do to support, that enable us to do what we actually do. And what we actually do, just calling back to what you have said multiple times on previous episodes, what you do is you solve problems.
Yeah.
And that might be with software, or it might be with something else, but that's what we do. And actually, you know, it's not necessarily we're solving problems. Sometimes we are creating new markets. Sometimes we are creating new things. So it's not always just solving problems, but effectively we're not writing software for the sake of writing software. We do that in our spare time, in our side projects, but for work, people don't pay us to write perfectly architected code.
No. We did a whole episode about that, right?
Absolutely, we did. Absolutely. And that's the point, right? Nobody gives a fuck about the code, right? Yeah. A company that wants someone to develop software for them, let's say you want a CRM, right? That company does not give a shit about whether you're using DDD. They don't care about what architecture you've chosen. They don't care about following best practices or any of that shit, right? What they care about is that they have a system that lets them manage their customer relationships, easily retrieve records when they're talking to a customer, potentially identify new opportunities and leads, so on and so forth. That's what they want, right?
Yeah.
That's what actually matters.
Yes.
So are we completely wrong about everything? Like, who cares? Why are we putting effort into even discussing TDD, vertical slice architecture versus clean architecture? Hint, all architectures are the same. That's a whole other topic.
Yep.
Like, do your tests represent the functionality of the system, or do they prevent someone breaking it in the future? Like, are we just wrong about all this? Does any of this matter? At the end of the day, if the only thing that matters to the paying client is that we deliver a functioning solution, is that in fact then the only thing that matters?
To go back to your analogy, right?
Yeah.
To go back to the analogy, your procurement department.
Yeah.
Actually, that's probably not the best option there, because they are quite pivotal to getting stock on the shelves, right?
Yeah.
But
they are part of that chain of that core business.
They are part of the core business chain. They are. But okay, to stretch the analogy, if you were vertically integrated and you had your own warehousing systems and you had your own shipping systems and whatnot,
yeah,
arguably they're not part of the core business,
right?
Except they facilitate a better product. Okay. A cheaper product.
They're not, to just flip the analogy back, they're not part of the core business to the same extent that something like Azure is not part of the core business.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to get at there though is they can provide additional services and additional benefits to the organization that help streamline processes, that can reduce the cost, get better products, better quality, lower cost to the end user, to the end consumer.
Yeah.
Right. So no, they're not core to the day-to-day running of the business, but they are core for the business to achieve its goal.
Yes.
Right. And in that respect, could there be an argument to be made that the patterns and practices that you've just mentioned, that you've rattled off, that they are they can be utilized in a very similar fashion, or thought of in a very similar fashion, in that, no, they're not there part of the core business. However, they are there to help facilitate that business and to make sure that there are no bugs in the system, to make sure that the building of that software that is the core business actually does exactly what it's meant to do, that it handles the workload that's meant to come through it, that it can scale, and that it can grow with the needs of the business.
Okay. So there's two sides to this. So I should start by saying that I'm being deliberately challenging here, because obviously I do have an opinion on this, and I do believe that these patterns and practices are incredibly important, actually. I would even go so far as to say they're necessary, but in the right place and the right time, and I'll get to that, right?
Yep.
Yes. But to keep flogging this analogy, right? So there's three parts to what you just said, right? Now, the first part is making sure that you're delivering that core business.
Yep.
And then the second and third parts actually were about effectively maintaining, but in different ways. So, but just to focus on that first part, these patterns and practices should therefore be valuable insofar as they ensure that the product delivers what the paying customers of that product need it to do.
Yes.
So I'll go back to, so in terms of putting, let's say we've got a bucket and we're going to put things into this bucket, things that we say, okay, we acknowledge that these deliver value. So I think TDD we can put in there. We say, all right, so TDD is valuable if we are writing tests or defining tests that assert the functionality of the product in terms expressed by the business, as opposed to in terms expressed by the developers.
Yep. Okay. I can get on board with that.
Therefore, we can also say that TDD in isolation on its own, being practiced by TDT practitioners, is potentially problematic. And this, just thinking back to Chris's talk that we harp on about a lot, I think if you pair TDD with DDD, and we can say, okay, well, let's put DDD in this bucket, because DDD is all about ensuring you're delivering the right functionality for the business, right? So there's two sides to DDD, that, as we've spoken about a lot, right? And one of those sides is about implementation and, you know, technical implementation, and is not necessarily that tightly coupled to the, I guess, the philosophical side. Someone could come along tomorrow and say, here's a better way of writing your code that aligns with DDD. It's completely different to what we're doing now. And it would still technically be DDD, because DDD isn't about how you organize your code. It's about how you interpret and deliver value.
Yeah, it's about, in my interpretation of it, is when it comes down to it, it's about putting the domain at the heart of the model, right? And what, and to me, the terminology there is quite ambiguous deliberately.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be prescriptive about this is exactly how it's done. You want to, as a philosophy, you want to make sure that the domain is at the very heart of what you're building, what you're modeling, what you're constructing. Because obviously the software we write is effectively, it's a model of a real world system.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. It's not the actual system. It's a model of the system. It's a model of that domain. So we want to make sure that the domain is in the heart of that. And the simple fact is that does not say you must follow these patterns. It does not say you must use aggregates and repositories and ubiquitous languages and whatnot. But it's saying these things will help facilitate it.
The language part, it probably does say you should do that.
Well, I guess by definition, yes, you're right there. But I guess it's less prescriptive about the implementation.
Yes, yeah.
And my big takeaway from being exposed to domain-driven design for 20 plus years now is pretty much based on that philosophy that the heart of everything you do should be really, well, it's about the domain problem that we're solving. It's not about writing software.
Interesting. So what we're saying is that DDD kind of is a self-referential anti-pattern.
Look, and I don't know if I'm sort of jumping the gun here, but and I think I kind of where you're alluding to is this pattern in the industry for jumping onto the latest and greatest design patterns and going whole hog into them, be it, or not even design pattern, but be it, you know, Agile and Scrum, BDD, TDD, DDD.
So CA.
Absolutely. And
microservices,
right? did you just say microservices?
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And it's this, or as we've alluded to in the past, it's resume-driven development.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
RDD. And and it's going down the path of choosing whatever pattern or methodology you choose without actually thinking through the whole process of why does this pattern exist?
Yeah.
What problem is it designed to solve? And is it the most appropriate pattern or methodology to use right now?
Yes, agreed.
And I remember one of the very first, very early on in my career, you know, I was a proud enterprise developer, you know, we building all these enterprise applications, and got to the end of a big project. And I was talking to a mentor of mine and explaining to him outside, like completely randomly one day, and, you know, just saying, you know, we've done this and whatnot. And he was, you know, really digging in and asking the questions like, okay, so, you know, what patterns did you use? And I was talking about dependency injection and abstracting out the database into your repository layer and having all these ORMs and everything in place and whatnot, and interfaces left, right, and center so that you could change your dependencies at whenever you wanted and all of this. And then he's looked at me. He's like, yeah, but, and you will, okay, just to a bit of background there was, you know, the one of the arguments for using an ORM and repository pattern, you know, is, oh, well, if we want to change our database technology or database provider down the track, we can easily swap, you know, an SQL database for a NoSQL database or whatever else, or an SQL for a MySQL or a Postgres, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And I'm talking to him and I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, it was capable of doing all this stuff. He's just looked at me. He's like, when was the last time you ever changed the database technology of a production system?
them. Yeah.
And that was a light bulb moment that went off for me, which completely sums up the discussion we're having right now.
Yep.
Right. Early on, when I was on that team, we were building it according to best practices, doing what was the right way to do things, the, in, you know, in quotes, right way to do things, without actually questioning whether it was required or whether it would be needed.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
You know, long before I heard the term YAGNI,
yep,
we were building a system that could handle a database being lifted and shifted out from underneath it and the whole technology stack changing.
Yeah.
But guess what? They probably kept that database, exact same database system, exact same database server running for years on end.
Yep, no doubt.
No one ever bothered to think, oh, do we need to change it?
Yeah, yeah. So one of the most common logical reasonings for why to build clean code or clean architecture or abstracted code or whatever, it's, oh, well, you can, you know, you can change your database. It's like, yeah, well, who's ever done that? And it does happen, right? It does happen, but it's certainly not something that happens enough to warrant architecting your code around, right? As it happens, by the way, as an aside, that enterprise customer that I have been working for recently that we've spoken about a few times that you're familiar with, I really want to swap their database. I really do. And I really want to swap it from a relational to a NoSQL for a whole bunch of reasons. And I really wish we'd done it that way, but we didn't know, right? So
yep.
Anyway, that's kind of off topic, but it's not for other reasons. So yeah, look, I agree. And if you remember when I think you came to my talk at NDC in February, and I spoke about all this. I think personally, the three most dangerous words in a code review are just in case.
No, yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, I agree. Now, just getting back to the point we were making before. So we've taken TDD and we've taken DDD and we've put them in our bucket where we've said, well, okay, well, maybe not, we're not wrong about those. Okay. So I think we can look at some other practices, patterns, architectures, all these other things, right? And we can ask, we can, you know, go through them and look at them and ask, do we put them in this bucket or not? But let me just change direction a little bit here and let me ask you a different question. How many software projects have you been on that have failed? And let me be more clear. Let me give you a tighter definition of failed. How many software projects have you been on where the product was not eventually delivered into production?
A few. I can't recall off the top of my head numbers, but I mean, it certainly happens.
Okay. Can you identify a common theme between all of those projects, or were the reasons for their failure unique to each one?
Look, the themes usually around poorly defined specifications, requirements.
Okay. Right?
So the problem space is not thought out properly, or it's underestimated.
Yeah.
And then you just over completely blow out the budget.
Yeah.
Which could, again, come back to poorly defined requirements.
Yeah.
But generally around those respects.
So if you think back to our lean startup episode, having poorly defined requirements shouldn't really matter that much, which is obviously bullshit, but just I'm phrasing it. I'm not really playing devil's advocate, but I'm just kind of offering this perspective.
Yeah.
It shouldn't really matter, right? Because you should be building in such a way that you can pivot, right?
Yep.
Now, building in such a way that you can pivot means following good practices and patterns that allow you to change what you're doing.
Yeah, I see where you're going.
Yeah. But let me offer you an alternative perspective. So I have also been on a few software projects that have failed, never made it to production. And I would argue that the common theme across all of them is, if not root cause, but certainly a common factor and certainly a contributing factor in many, if not all of them, too much time spent on engineering as opposed to delivering functionality.
Yeah, I can say that. That's a pretty valuable insight. But let me ask you another question then. Have you seen projects fail due to a lack of engineering?
Yes, I have. Well, actually, no. No, I haven't. What I have seen, and this is kind of a bit counter to where I'm going with this whole thing, because just a bit of a spoiler is I don't think we're wrong about all these things. I think we do need good engineering and we do need practices and patterns and all the good stuff that we do. But I think that we need those because they enable us to deliver the product. And I think it's important not to lose sight of that, right? And I think it's important to remember that the cool engineering or the great new architecture or the, you know, the really good new pattern or approach that you followed might be fun for you to learn as a developer, but that's not what we're here to do, right? What we're here to do is deliver the functionality that the client, the product owner, the business, whatever you want to call it, what they want, what they need. Now, have I seen projects fail due to lack of engineering? Well, there's a yes and a no to that, right? And it depends on your definition of fail, really, is the big one. I have seen projects that have desperately needed rescuing from a lack of engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen projects where so many actually, where the tech debt has piled up to the point where the velocity has effectively reached zero.
Mm-hmm.
See, I've seen that multiple times. And actually, often that happens as a result of a patchwork of golden hammer architectures or patterns where either the dev team has been replaced and whoever's come along has disregarded what's there and started doing new things in their new way, or dev has got distracted by some shiny new pattern or architecture and then they've just started doing something else and it's a mess, right?
Yep.
So that's often what I've seen. I've also seen, and I'm going to offer a counterpoint to this, I've also seen projects that, again, I wouldn't necessarily say have failed, but have desperately needed rescuing, where the complete opposite has been done, where there's been no planning or architecture. It's effectively a proof of concept
yep.
that someone has showed to a product owner, and a product owner has said, great, ship it.
Yep, but effectively an MVP in its truest form.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Now, the counterpoint to all of this, and I would argue that that's actually the right thing to do, right? Because I think the most important thing is delivering the product.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can, you know, and again, I guess it depends if you've got a, you know, a long-lived plan, you know, if you've got a five-year product roadmap, and that requires you building a strong foundation and expanding on it, and you've got a very clear vision for what you want to do. And yeah, it's good to start right away with some good practices in place that are going to allow you to easily maintain that code in the future. Because that's, again, important to the business. The business may not care about your code, and they may not care about what patterns or architectures or practices you're following, but they are going to care when they get the bill, right? So if something should cost $1 million and costs $15 million, and it really needn't have cost, you know, that 15 million if people have done things the quote unquote right way.
Mm.
And I would also argue that the right way is the thing that defines a way as being right is consistency. But again, that's not a whole other topic. We can unpack that a bit later as well if you want. But yeah, so, you know, I've seen projects where the budget has ballooned out because things have not been defined in a clear yeah. way with good patterns and practices. So
I guess a counter argument to that though is, right, yeah, there's the, you know, the client's not going to be happy if you have $1 million budget and you end up spending 15 because you've over-engineered something, right? But the counter to this is if the client's got $1 million budget and you come in and you put in a below par job,
yeah.
you do zero engineering, you charge them $1 million, they get the product, it looks like it's doing what it needs to do, and that's all well and good.
Yeah.
Then they want to add an extra feature,
yeah.
and then add an extra feature, and then add an extra feature. And all of a sudden, to add those three extra features, it costs them an extra $20 million.
Yeah, 100%.
Whereas if you've engineered it properly the first way, and to use the term you mentioned earlier, tech debt, to make sure that there's minimal tech debt in the code base, and spending a bit more time up front, it might maybe cost you $2 million. In that instance, it might cost you $2 million, not one, but then the additional three features they want might only end up costing another two, right? So all up, to get everything that they want, they might only be in the pocket for about five as opposed to the 25 the first time.
I agree. So, I mean, look, I think, you know, let's say you've got a product roadmap and you've got 10 features, right? You might say the first feature is going to cost you $2 million because we're going to need to do a lot of work to establish the product. But yep. then features 2 through 9 are going to cost you $1 million each.
Yep.
So the whole product is going to cost you $11 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously a lot better than saying, okay, so the first feature is only going to cost you $500,000, but then the second feature is going to cost you $1 million. And then the third is going to cost you $3 million.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth, right? Potentially doubling each time until you end up spending however many
yeah.
tens or hundreds of millions of dollars because you haven't engineered it properly. So right. yeah, so in that respect, engineering is important and the business does care about your code. Although more precisely, as I said, they actually don't care about your code. They care about the bill.
Yeah.
So you have a responsibility as a developer or as a professional, not just to deliver functionality, but to keep the costs down. So you don't want to just give them any old piece of garbage that is going to cost them more money over the long term. You want to give them the best long-term outcome. There's a whole other topic around that we can dive into involving project managers and short-term goals versus long-term goals. Mm. But I think that's a discussion for another time.
Yep.
But yeah, we can definitely talk about that. But yeah. So look, I guess where I'm going with this, right, is essentially I do believe that those patterns and practices are important. And I have seen projects fail because of over-engineering, and I have seen projects fail because of under-engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the most important thing is never to lose sight of the fact that what you're building, you're not building it for yourself as a developer, as an engineering exercise. Unless, of course, you are, in fact, building it for yourself as an engineering exercise. But that's not what we're talking about here, right?
No.
We're talking about what we do, which is building software for our clients. And our clients may be external, they may be our employer, what have you, right? But that's what we do, right? So if I'm working for my retail chain, and I'm building a CRM system for them, that's not an engineering exercise. Now, it may be an engineering exercise if I come to my boss or the product owner one day and I say, I saw a talk on a new OpenAI feature available on Azure, and I believe that I can deliver XYZ business value. So I want you to approve me spending two sprints on a tech spike building this functionality and seeing if I can do it and make it work.
Yeah.
That's then an engineering exercise. Sure. But
that's not what we're talking about here, right?
It's not what we're talking about. No. But there are some rules that apply to that as well, which I'll come back to. But no, what we're talking about is we're building the CRM or whatever it is, the payroll system, what have you. It's not an engineering exercise. It's just like any other professional in any of those other kind of ancillary departments that we spoke about, be it HR, facilities, or what have you. Like, let's say, you know, I'm the facilities manager, right?
Mm.
And there's some awesome new remote control door system that I want to put in. Yeah, I don't get to just put that in because I think it's cool. Actually, if it delivers better security, that is an increment that we require as a business, there's a business case for it, sure. But otherwise, I don't just get to go and do that because it's cool. And we as developers don't get to do that either.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Of course, we get to hide a lot of what we do behind jargon, which is another problem. So we A, get away with a bit more, and B, don't necessarily get away with a bit more, but have more leniency and a reputation for it.
Yeah, and I've got written down here in my notes, right, and where you've said, you know, we can get away with this by just rolling off jargon, right? And in my notes here, I've got the word tech debt underlined.
Yeah.
And then underneath it, it says, is this an overused excuse?
Yeah.
Right. Do we as a profession overuse the term tech debt as an excuse for us to over-engineer?
Well, yes, we do. We do. And we introduce a lot of tech debt through over-engineering.
Yep.
I used to work with someone who had a really great reputation in the company for being someone who could ferret out opportunities and businesses, you know, opportunities with clients.
Yep.
Right. So this guy would get booked for a client and he'd get booked to do some work, let's say $250,000. And he'd end up doing $400,000-$500,000 worth of work because by doing what he was doing, he'd be like, oh, well, actually, you know, you've got this problem and I'm blocked. Yep. So I need to fix that. And now I found this problem and I'm blocked. So I need to fix that. What was actually happening was this guy had no idea what he was doing. So he was finding excuses to take longer to deliver the work.
Yeah. I've seen that happen recently with someone a startup I was advising.
Yeah.
And like, we're just not getting, you know, every time we think we're getting to the end and he just keeps pushing us back. And I'm like, the guy doesn't want to be found out.
Yeah.
He doesn't want the product to go live because he doesn't want to be found out that it's not standing up to expectations.
Yeah. Look, just to get back to what I was saying, right, is that I've seen projects fail because of over-engineering, also seen projects fail because of under-engineering.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with under-engineering side of it, though, is not, in my view, an engineering problem. That's a product ownership problem, because I've seen this happen a lot where someone has built an MVP or a prototype or a POC, and the product owner has said, awesome, ship it, right?
Yep.
I was like, well, okay, we'll ship it, but you know that for the next iteration, we have to start again, because this is a garbage pile of tech debt, excuse or no excuse, because we didn't engineer this. We literally built it to prove the concept or to see if we could do it. And going back to that two sprint example for the engineer who's discovered this new OpenAI feature, essentially, if you think of that as a product in itself, this feature is a mini product. Right? You're doing a POC, you're doing a spike, you're doing your MVP, what have you. It's an engineering exercise. I would expect you to very quickly build that and build it dirty and come back to the product owner and say, I've spent as little time on this as possible to prove or demonstrate or determine whether or not this idea has value to the business.
Yep.
So I don't want you, if I'm the product owner, I don't want you to spend 2 weeks engineering the perfect, you know, the perfect feature, the perfect system, just to test this theory of whether this new Azure OpenAI service can increase value. I want you to do that quick and dirty and come back to me for as little money as possible.
Yeah.
Not with a working product, but with an answer to the question of, can we get value out of this? Then that's when we say, okay, now go back and put the effort and the time into engineering this properly.
Absolutely. And I think you find a lot of, well, some of the larger tech organizations or a lot of organizations run hack days for that exact reason.
Yeah.
Right. Let's just open everyone's imagination to creatively find solutions to problems or products, openings or offerings or things that they would never normally think about.
Yeah.
Just to get that ball rolling.
Yeah.
And then as an outcome of the hack day, or arguably, I think as Google, right? Gmail was famously a 20% project.
Yep.
Right. That kind of thinking lets people get into that space of, okay, well, let's just do this MVP to test the waters.
Yeah.
And arguably, if you take an MVP back to its very root definition, it does not have to be a technical implementation, right? Famously, famously, the guys at Airbnb were advised early on, and I can't remember who it was. It could have been Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn fame, I think it was, advised them, right? Do things that don't scale in your MVP, right? I've heard of organizations where, like, they just do a hand, if it's an automation system that you want to build, to manually do those processes for the first half a dozen customers.
Yeah.
Just to prove that there is demand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we can talk about this more if we explore the topic that I raised earlier about around project managers, right? But if a client comes to me and says, we've spent 7 years and we've invested X number of hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars into this product and it just doesn't scale, right? I don't necessarily phrase it this way, but my feeling on that is the problem isn't that the product doesn't scale. The problem is that you've invested all that money in it, right?
Yeah.
What you should have done was after 6 months, instead of riding that train and that momentum and saying, this is awesome, let's just keep adding more scar tissue on top of that same, you know, the same pile that we've already got, should have stopped and rebuilt it. That's the problem.
Yep.
Now, of course, it's obviously very easy to say that in hindsight, but they may not have had the funding, they may not have had the budget, they may not have had the earnings forecast. You just don't know. So, you know, I never say that because you don't know the full picture.
Yeah.
And that's only evident as being the problem in hindsight, with the benefit of hindsight.
Yep.
So that's, you know, certainly not what I say to clients, because it's a very good chance that it was the right decision at the time. Although I still feel it's probably a misguided decision, because I personally feel that the right way to build software is to start with a quick and dirty proof of concept and then throw it in the bin and then build something well architected and well designed using all those nice patterns and practices that we can get out of our bucket.
Yeah, I in principle, I agree with that.
But it
in
depends.
In practice, I find that very hard to do.
Yeah.
And another thing I've got written down here, and kind of to loop back to something you mentioned earlier about developers wanting to just either cut code and do the quickest, dirtiest solution possible, or to properly engineer a solution. And I think it also comes down to a level of job satisfaction and pride in your work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? If I'm not working in that space where I am engineering it in a way that I feel is future-proofing it, I hesitate to use that word, future-proofing, but, you know, engineering it in such a way, I kind of don't end up with that level of job satisfaction or that pride in what I'm doing. And I think that is still, that's an intangible, valuable outcome of the work that we're presenting.
Let me put this another way, right? Do you write loosely coupled code?
To the best of my ability.
Why?
Because tightly coupled code becomes harder to maintain.
Right.
Harder to scale, harder to grow.
Okay. Harder to maintain doesn't scale. So the bread and butter of our work.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would argue that, and I'm not, well, I would argue because it's the purpose of this discussion, but I'm not necessarily saying this is the position I take. But I could argue that don't waste your time writing abstracted, clean, decoupled code. Just build the product. Now, the problem is, in fact, this same argument that I'm about to make applies to architecture as well. So don't worry about building this architecture that is going to allow you to scale and maintain it. And I'll say why the same reasoning applies to both, right? Build the product, work on the product, write new code, but be cognizant of the point at which you say, I can't keep doing what I'm doing here because this is going to become impossible to maintain and it's not going to scale. So now what I need to do is make this an abstraction. Now what I need to do is re-architect this, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that, and while this is a problem, I do still think that potentially this is something that we should do more. But the problem with that is that that requires a certain level of cognitive load. And that means that while you're working on this code base, if you think of your attention as a budget, right? And let's say you got $10, you want to be spending that $10 delivering business value or as much as possible.
Yep.
But now you're saying actually $3 needs to be constantly on the lookout and vigilant for architectural problems or anti-patterns or what have you, right?
Yep.
So just to flip-flop back and forth again, by investing that effort up front in architecting it or engineering it in such a way that those decisions are already made for you, you remove that cognitive load.
Yes.
And therefore you focus on delivering the business value.
And hence the reason why we see these things like clean architecture and vertical slice architecture, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
To remove that cognitive overload.
I once said in a talk that I use clean architecture even for trivial projects.
Yep.
Not for clients, but for myself. And the reason I do that is because I'm familiar with it. I use it all the time. And therefore, it saves me having to put in the effort into choosing an architecture.
Yep.
And it saves me having to put in, it already removes the cognitive load. I don't have to think when I'm adding a new feature, where do I put this file? Where do I put this feature? How do I implement this? So all those decisions are made for me and I can just focus on the functionality.
You know, as I mentioned earlier, I've been putting a few proposals together recently and working on quite closely with startups who clearly have quite a limited budget, right?
Yeah.
Now, being able to articulate to them that we will work to best engineering practices, which could come across as being, hey, this is going to be very expensive, but trying to also sort of thread that needle that then says, but we will do it in such a way that will respect the fact that you are a startup.
Yeah.
We're not going to take the piss and over-engineer something and try and drain your budget straight away, because that's not going to serve anyone any benefit, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, you do want a product that's going to be robust enough for you to have your business survive on, but you're not, I don't want to over-engineer it from the day one.
Yeah, I mean, look, this really harks back to our nobody gives a fuck about your code episode, right? And also, actually, do you remember the can you afford a tech startup conversation we had?
Yep.
Right. So I think a startup with limited budget, they're probably going to say to you, okay, we see the value in what you're saying, but we're going to go with old mate on Fiverr or Upwork, who's going to charge us $5 an hour because it's going to cost us $5 an hour. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, I think there's a huge element of risk in that, in that, well, okay, do you have, and this is something you spoke about when we were, maybe this was in the tech startup episode, I'm not sure, but you specifically said that if you're going to do that, you need to effectively have a CTO, or you need to have someone who's a tech lead on staff who can oversee that work and make sure that that's being done to the standard that you want and in line with the expected delivery and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a massive amount of risk. So you might end up paying this person, I mean, it's realistically not going to be $5 an hour, but I mean, it might, but you know, you might get that lower hourly rate, but there's a very significant risk that you're going to pay a lot more hours.
Yeah.
No, in fact, the reality is it's going to be more hours, but the risk is that those additional hours could balloon out more than the original budget. But I think all of that aside, that's a conversation you can have. You know, if your clients are saying to you, your budget is too high and we recognize the value, however, we actually intentionally want to go with this lower value one right now because our budget is limited. We're a startup and our priority right now is getting a functioning MVP or prototype or whatever out the door, getting the website stood up, getting the product stood up. So maybe there's an opportunity there for you to say to them, well, I can offer you CTO as a service where instead of you taking me on full time, I can oversee these cheaper developers for you. But that aside, right, the main thing is, and we definitely spoke about this on the Can You Afford a Tech Startup episode. The main point is you can say to them, okay, well, you're a startup. You have to go with that option because that's what your budget dictates. Fine.
Yep.
It's important for you to recognize as a business that factored into your longer term business plan is a requirement to refactor that.
Yep.
Because as we said, it doesn't scale, right? It's unmaintainable, right? So there comes a point.
But then this comes back to the whole argument about can you afford, the nobody gives a fuck about your code episode, right?
Yeah.
Well, the original thought process around that was, well, if all I'm doing is building the MVP to raise some funds, then absolutely that's the right thing. But also if it's to get to a point where they can just sell the company and move on, do they really care about how I engineered this?
Well, again, this is another question that we've discussed. This actually may have come up in that discussion with Chris. I'm not 100% sure. Maybe it was a different one. This is something we spoke about, right? When a company, you know, let's say you've got a software product, you've got a SaaS product, and someone comes along and they want to acquire you. The quality of your code is certainly a factor in that decision, but that is more likely a factor in their business plan than in their decision of whether or not to buy the company, right?
Yep.
So if someone comes along and looks at your code and it's absolute garbage, right? You've got 500 customers, you can maybe get to 1,000 customers, but your code base is not going to allow you to scale beyond 1,000 customers.
Yep.
It's unlikely that they're going to look at that. Well, it's unlikely with those the numbers, forget the numbers of customers. Let's just say that's for illustration. But it's unlikely that they're going to look at that and they're going to say, well, okay, well, we're not going to buy the company because your product's never going to scale, right? Yeah. Because they're not really buying your product. And again, going, this is something we've said before as well. Unless your product is some kind of proprietary algorithm that can do something that no one else can do, they don't care about your code.
Yeah.
They're not buying your company for your code. They're buying your company for your established customer
IP.
Base. Right. So what's going to happen is they're going to look at it and they're going to say, well, okay, this code's great. This is going to scale. We love it. We're going to buy it. Or they're going to look at it and say, this code is problematic. There's a risk here. We need to factor into our plan that we're going to need to spend $100,000 refactoring this in order to get past that 1,000 user threshold. So actually, we're going to drop our bid by $100,000, or not. I don't know, right?
Yep.
But that's realistically what's going to happen there if they're savvy enough to know that that's what they got to do.
Absolutely. So without dragging on too much more, Matt, are we wrong about everything?
Yes. And no, it depends.
Of course it does. Of course it does. And I think sort of as we're sort of wrapping it up, the other thing I've got written down in my notes here is just the word why.
Yeah.
And when it comes to implementing a lot of the practices, the patterns, the methodologies that we're working on, really comes down to understanding why they exist. What problems are they trying to solve? There is absolutely no reason in implementing a microservices architecture if it doesn't solve the problems that you're going to face. Right? If all you need is a single page application that's serving up a small database that's only going to handle a workload of 100 users maximum, do you really need to go down the path of microservices architecture, right?
Do you ever?
There's a lot of businesses around right now sort of asking that question again. But my point there is, I think with everything, and you know, I like to use this philosophy with a lot of things, is, and I've mentioned this before, start with why, right?
Yeah.
Understand why they exist. Why do we want to use DDD or TDD? And if you understand the why, then you can understand, well, is it the most appropriate thing for the problem that I'm looking at right now?
Yes, agreed. Although I still think the why isn't the why of the why do these patterns and practices exist is important, but it's still a secondary principle in my view. The primary why am I building this?
Because the customer's paying the bills.
Yeah, that's right. You know, why am I writing Goldie CRM 3000? Well, because it's a CRM, not because it's an engineering challenge. So the patterns and practices are great because they're going to enable the product to scale, reduce costs and total cost of ownership over time, and all that other good stuff. But Goldie CRM 3000 doesn't exist to be a microservices solution or, you know, a DDD solution or a TDD solution or a solid solution or whatever else, any of the TLAs we want to throw at it, right? It exists to be to manage customer relationships.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, I think we can agree that we're not wrong about everything, but I wonder what anyone else's opinions are on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the best way for that is, as we keep saying, Matt, to reach out to us on the socials.
Yep. So we've got at Beer Driven Devs on Twitter.
Yep.
I'm at Matt Goldman.
I'm at Liam Elliott _AU, and we're on LinkedIn too.
Yeah.
Yep. But I think there's also another, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, Matt, there's we're going to make an appearance down at the ADA Conf in Melbourne later this year. And it'd be awesome to chat in person, especially at an analysis, design and architecture conference. I think this topic's pretty poignant.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it'd be great for people to come and chat with us and let us know what they think.
Yeah. So we were talking to Chris earlier this week, and they've kindly offered us a discount code. So if you use the code BDD15, you'll get 15% off your ticket price.
That's awesome. And where would people go to do that?
That's a good point. Where would people go? It's adaconf.org, and we'll obviously link to it all on our socials and on the show notes.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. Well, yeah, it'd certainly be great if any listeners of the show can come and chat to us at adaconf, and we're looking forward to it. So for now, I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Matt Goldman.
I'm Liam Elliott. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Oh, yeah. I think I've had too much. One victory.
Again, or not enough.
Sorry?
Or not enough.
Or not enough. Oh, no.
Right,
it's not too bad. This is a local brewery.